Rome Works, An Architect Explores the World's Most Resilient City by Tom Rankin. Introduction, Why Rome? First Impressions. The train, as I recall, is on time. It pulls slowly into Termini Station, the screeching of brakes giving way to the echoing announcements of departures and delays. Passengers arriving from Tuscany, Lombardy, or beyond begin to merge into the cosmopolitan chaos of Rome. I say goodbye to new acquaintances, a handful of backpackers like myself, a quiet Franciscan priest, and a boisterous bearded political science student who had been eager to share anti-American and anti-clerical sentiments, but was frustrated by the language barrier. From the train window, I watched as green fields and rolling hills abruptly gave way to massive urban apartment blocks. Fleeting glimpses of private lives floated by. Balconies, dim interiors seen through open windows. Bright sheets hung in the sun. A child on a balcony. An old man in a white undershirt smoking. An overgrown garden. A junkyard filled with wrecked cars. A Roman wall. Actually, it's the Roman wall, the Aurelian wall. And one of its gates, the Porta Maggiore. Above, I see the cross-sections of ancient aqueducts and peer in passing into concrete corridors which once carried Rome's water. Then alongside another stretch of aqueducts, I glimpse a broken octagonal dome and recognize the ruins of the ancient temple of Minerva Medica. Before the train has begun braking, I'm overwhelmed. Now in the station, descending the narrow steps, a stench like old public restrooms rises from the litter-strewn tracks and blends with the smoke of freshly lit cigarettes. Why the sudden need to light up, I wonder? Everyone had been smoking in the aisle of the train for the whole trip. This was back in 1983, long before smoking bans reached Italy. I pause on the platform to let first impressions form. As the smoke clears, I observe the crisp, repetitive lines of the station's mosaic-faced concrete canopies that frame the deep blue October sky. The late afternoon sun is warm, but I move several steps into the shade and feel its cooling effect. Then I hear the water. It bubbles continuously like a tiny mountain spring from a black basalt stone fountain, elegantly incorporated into the base of the dark stone piers. I stoop to drink, and the water is cold and sweet. Slow architecture. I'm an architect who feels little need to build. For every 1,000 Italians, there are approximately two architects, one every 2 square kilometers. Rome alone has 18,000 architects, a stable population, and a stock of buildings that has been growing on and off for millennia. The city which I have called home for 2 decades has many needs, but new architecture is not foremost among them. The challenge today is not growth, but restraint. Not building more, but using better that which we have. Not reinventing the city, but rethinking how we live the city. Cities use about 75% of the Earth's resources and produce the same percentage of greenhouse gases. But this doesn't mean, as previous generations suggested, that the solution to crisis is to abandon the city. If, as some environmentalists once suggested, we commune with nature, we risk destroying the very wilderness that we claim to cherish. No, we are urban animals, and the city is our nature. From environmentalists to urbanists to administrators, people are finally waking up to the realization that if we can fix our cities, we stand at least a chance of fixing our planet. At the start of the modern era, cities were, often rightly, depicted as concentrations of pollution, injustice, and waste. But this is no longer true. As our industries have gone from gray to green or moved to distant shores, which is another story, most of the negative consequences of urbanism have vaporized. Instead, cities offer the best, perhaps the only, venue in which to build a new economy that, in Lester Brown's words, is powered largely by renewable sources of energy, boasts a much more diversified transport system, and that reuses and recycles everything. So if, as Jaime Lerner, the former mayor of Curitiba, Brazil, has succinctly put it, cities aren't the problem, they're the solution, we should look carefully at Rome, the quintessential city. It may no longer be Caput Mundi, as the Romans saw it, but there is perhaps no more archetypal city in the world, making it an important laboratory for the inevitable transition which world cities will undergo if they're to survive. Thank you. Welcome to the real world. From my expat vantage point, I was no longer able to believe some impossible bella vita under the Roman sun now that I was dealing with it on a daily basis, nor would I let stand the stereotypes many Italians harbored about America, either to idealize or to vilify it. All that was left was to share my unique perspective in hopes that I could lend insight to Romans and outsiders alike. I had one foot in the architectural milieu, mired in its dense history and muddy theorizing, rich and seductive, but with surprisingly little relevance, especially since I was in no position to win international competitions, which might, by some remote turn of events, have spelled success for me, as opposed to Rome's other 18,000 architects, or for that matter, any of the world's millions of architects who would have given their right arm to build in Rome. If I had one foot in architecture, my other foot was in the real world. And this world, one of emerging global opportunities, fueled by digital media and communications, seemed inextricably linked to a cycle of production and consumption that led straight to planetary catastrophe. Or did it? Kenneth Frampton argues convincingly for a critical regionalism, for architecture as a force of resistance against what he calls universal civilization. Places grounded in history, topography, hydrology, places like Rome, might act as anti-entropic forces against the momentum of dumbed-down globalism. In Rome, I found these two worlds, that of culture and history, on the one hand, and that of urban ecology, on the other, able to coexist. Over time, lots of it, the city gradually emerged, reinforced by feedback loops, positive and negative both, pushing outwards, driven by internal forces usually wielded by an economic elite, though on occasion, such as the revolt of the plebs in the 2nd century BC, with grassroots instigation, but also limited by external constraints, the Tiber River, the Seven Hills, the Apennine Mountains, the Mediterranean Sea, availability of food, land, and building materials. Lewis Mumford, in his seminal work, The City in History, writes that our first task in our attempt to achieve a better insight into the present state of the city is to peer over the edge of the historic horizon to detect the dim traces of still earlier structures and more primitive functions. Certainly he had Rome in mind. Rome, more than most other cities, has seen a persistent and continuous process of expansion and retraction. Never completed, it's like modernism, an unfinished project. Yet unlike instrumental functionalism, striving towards some ideal complete state, Rome has accepted its flux as the condition of urbanism. Rome is a laboratory for environmental sustainability. To speak of environmental sustainability and Rome in the same sentence, or even in the same book, may seem surprising. By various standards, Rome is dragging its feet in meeting goals such as reducing its dependence on fossil fuels, eliminating waste of water and other materials, and improving air quality by cutting emissions. In recent years, Lega Ambiente's Ecosistema Italia report ranked Rome 75th out of 103 Italian cities. It rated for sustainable practices down from 62 its place in previous years. At a time when many nations, as they pursue their increasing commitment to sustainable city building, are looking for lessons from the past in the traditional urbanism of Rome and other Italian cities, contemporary Rome itself has drifted in the other direction, toward forms of urbanization that have been shown elsewhere to be unsustainable in other cultures, especially the U.S., in place of the tradition of dense pedestrian and transit-oriented neighborhoods, Rome has promoted peripheral dormitory and shopping developments, still only tenuously connected to the city except by private automobile. The 2003 Master Plan for Rome, in an expressed effort to jumpstart the polycentric organization of the city, called for 18 centralità urbane e metropolitane, monofunctional developments with commercial, educational, or cultural programs. It's up to the next generation of designers, entrepreneurs, policymakers, and citizens to see that these evolve into pieces of city, not just urbanized areas, a distinction that I think is fundamental. At a time when the planet is increasingly urban, the qualities of cities are changing. As urban population has boomed, the average density of cities has decreased. Are we really becoming more urban? In Rome, the current trends call into question the city's much-flaunted resilience. A city built upon centuries of adaptive reuse of both buildings and materials, there's a serious discussion of demolition of massive structures such as Corviale, the infamous kilometer-long public housing project, and Tor Bella Monica. Reusable San Pietrini cobblestones are being replaced with throwaway asphalt. In a city which, in antiquity, demonstrated a clear understanding of passive solar heating and natural ventilation, few buildings of the past two decades can be said to have been designed on principles of solar thermal heating or cooling. In a city which can still boast one of the largest percentages of agricultural land within its boundaries, each year thousands of acres of fertile soil are being given over to urbanization. A city which in the post-war years developed not just a network, but a whole culture of buses and trams, now has the highest per capita driving private automobile usage in Europe. And last but not least, a capital whose rise to power was thanks in great part to an abundant and equitably distributed water supply, is now moving towards the privatization of that water. It's enough to look around Rome or read numerous Rome-based public advocacy blogs like my own to dismiss any notion that the Eternal City today is a model of ecological urbanism. That title might go to Vancouver or Copenhagen or even to Curitiba or London or to Siena here in Italy, which is number 6 on Legambiente list, but certainly not to Rome. However, I'm suggesting Rome not as a model, but as a laboratory. That is, a venue in which to carry out research, to work on problems, as the etymology of the word reminds us. A laboratory is a place where scientific work gets done. In her last book, Dark Age Ahead, one of the world's great urban thinkers, Jane Jacobs, praises, or eulogizes, the scientific method through which a fruitful question is posed, a hypothetical answer proposed, then tested, leading to the next fruitful question. It's through such rigorous work, not through heroic gestures, that the hard problems are solved and the species evolves. Science and design are often seen as opposites, the former wide open to all knowledge, while the latter invariably narrows down the choices to one out of infinite possibilities, one color, one choice. But when it comes to the study of the city, science and culture comprise. But when it comes to the study of the city, science and culture comprise a unified field of inquiry. The late Italian architect Aldo Rossi, author of one of the landmark architectural texts of the last century, The Architecture of the City, often slipped the term scientific into his discourse, the scientific autobiography, the little scientific theater, etc. Italian examples of science and culture finding common ground, or at least promiscuity, abound. Vitruvius, Hadrian, the Arcadian movement, the Academy of the Lincei, Giordano Bruno, Enrico Fermi, Renzo Piano, the list could go on. Even the presence in Rome of NGOs such as the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, the World Food Program, point to the city's ambiguous position between science and public policy, between the global north and south. Sadly, we're in a period in which both culture and scientific research are under attack, their funding being cut, undermining seriously the sustainable future of Italian society. Jane Jacobs' discussion of the scientific method, in fact, pointed to cases in which it is being abandoned by the very people, such as traffic engineers, who purport to carry its torch. 7 themes. This book is structured around 7 themes, like the 7 early kings of Rome or the 7 hills on which they founded the city. Like Rome itself, these themes overlap and sometimes contradict one another. Is the Pantheon a classical temple or an early Christian church, a feat of engineering or a humanist hangout? Nevertheless, they will serve as useful organizational devices to rein in the complex history of a complex city. Rome at the start of the 21st century is at a tipping point, on the verge of falling again by abandoning a long, rich, and deeply established tradition, and instead adopting some of the worst aspects of American culture. And if it falls this time, it may not get back up. What's worse is that if Rome can't resist these superficial temptations, how can we expect China to? However, in each of the seven sustainability themes presented here, Rome could just as easily turn its efforts towards sustainable urban design and become not just a laboratory, but a world model for urban sustainability.